So, Dr. Koontz, why is the world upside down?
Well, possibly it's because of the influence of Christianity. They were accused, the early Christians, of turning the world upside down. But the sense that people have that the world is upside down, I think, is largely due to their media environment and the amount of time that people have devoted over the past, honestly, 150, 200 years to the consumption of news. And once you're inside some kind of news cycle, whether it takes a month because you're reading newspapers in the backwoods in the 19th century, or whether it's as fast as ours is today, you are easily appended because your sense of what's going on. I mean, I see this in people whose minds are dominated by news where, you know, they are freshly distraught over natural disasters the world over every single day, because the news tells them to be. And obviously we've talked about a lot of that with COVID, but people's sense of the world, I think, is governed to an insane degree by what they get from their screen, which is applies in an enormous way to the group we're talking about today, rather than the fact that the sun rises or the seasons are changing. You know, I recently found out about the Japanese concept of micro seasons, where you provide like a detailed ecological description of, you know, this is when these kinds of blossoms come out, or this is when in your, you know, place, these kinds of animals bear their young. That is much more real and natural than saying, hey, remember back when X horrendous violent incident happened? Oh, you didn't? That's because it got memory hold, or whatever your sense of the news cycle is.
I'm going to steal a little of your thunder here from later. Health is alignment of the body with the imagination in this upside down world of media ecology we swim in,
right,
as opposed to the alignment of life with the good of the body. And these stories from far away, as I like to call them, that cause so much distress. And in fact, you are then morally bound to have some sort of participation in their overcoming story, usually as well. That is indeed why your local experience might just feel a bit crazy. So there's a particle of English. It's not a word, but it shows up a lot. And in the last 10 years, it's just kind of, I think, lost its value, because I think words like transfer and transport and translation and transitory and transaction are good words. But transagenda, I don't know that I can be on board. It seems it's even taken the frontal of the word, you know, the prefix there, and made it something unto itself. So all these other words just have lost their meaning a little bit. And I'm a little concerned about that. So what do you think?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if you're old enough to remember when the, I don't know, nickname, I guess, for a car transmission was a tranny.
There you go. Yes. Exactly.
You know.
That's the point, though. Yeah.
You know, I mean, I'm so old at this point, I can remember signs that just said tranny shop.
Right, right. Well, you can throw another fag on the fire too, and get it all roaring, right? So
right, exactly. Exactly. And when language gets captured, something very powerful gets captured, because even though I'm, you know, one thing we're saying here is that biology should have a much greater primacy, as the local should have occupy more of your brain space than the, you know, disaster on the other side of the world necessarily. When language is captured, then your sense of the world is altered also on the local and in the personal. So the capacity to capture words and to hold them as territory, especially in a political fight, is extremely powerful. And they've done that with the prefix trans.
Words as territory. Increasingly, as I talk to my wife and my kids about how I lost my mind last year and have completely done a 180 on what I think the future holds, the large piece of it is too many inputs, people. Too many inputs. The territory that we would like to have our daily conversation in is being taken over and changed beneath our feet, and making it much more difficult to communicate, even in small quarters with people you love. And I think, you know, words being territory, this is just so huge. And so today's conversation about a particular word and a particular loss of meaning in a kind of a wide avenue of life is yet itself just a microcosm, I think, of the real power of what you said, that words are territory, and that there is a war, an info war going on these days that's much more potent than the shoot 'em up wars. Those still could and do happen, but the info war is the big one that's being waged all over the place.
I think that propaganda is a much smarter strategy for long-term change than violent wars if it's actually carried out successfully, because it gives little to no sense of defeat on the side whom you have radically changed. So you take, you know, the American population being relative to today, very, very religious, both by public opinion polling, but also by, you know, reported church membership being more trusting of basically any institution, maybe 50 years ago. And you get here and, you know, how did we get here? Well, I really, it's not an accident, and people's minds don't just change by accident. It's interesting how generational change is identified with completely different opinions by us, whereas it's not like that necessarily. I mean, you don't necessarily have to not think any of the things that your grandfather thought about life. It's not like there's not some sort of imperative in the same sense that, like, you have to grow up or you have to tie your own shoes. There's not the same sort of imperative that you must think none of the things that your grandfather thought. The way that that happens is through long-term propaganda that is willing to wait to change your mind. And transgenderism is such a good study in this, because in 13 years since then candidate Obama, Senator Obama, was running openly against gay marriage. Secretly, he's going to claim secretly, I always supported gay marriage, but openly against gay marriage with stable definitions of a man marries a man and a woman marries a woman. Now we're at the point where you can't dead name, use the, you know, actual biologically pertinent name of a person. You have to call, you know, what is it, the assistant health secretary, Rachel Levine instead of Richard Levine. So in 13 years, we have gone really far. And so the reason to pick transgenderism is because I think in all kinds of ways, as an ideology, not just its history, but as an ideology, it's such a good study in the power that propaganda has, because you have public figures who within the past decade have gone from never talking about something to saying it's totally beyond the pale if you don't say or do X, Y, or Z.
So I'm caught here in my own fear. I really want to do an Obama impression. And okay, as I speak, like the next thing, but I just don't know if I can pull it off. I think my Obama ain't bad, but I'm not gonna go public just yet. But change and hope, though. Change, yeah, and hope. I mean, they kind of meant it and they kind of didn't, right? Like, what did it mean? So let's get more narrow then. Yeah. With, you know, this has happened fast. In 10 years, you've done a full cultural reversal, at least on the surface. But it would, right, seem that there was work being done underneath before this. And now, yeah, what we also see, though, is that this is not a universal. The programming, which had led us to this point, it seems to have gotten a small minority of the country, but it's certainly not gotten the entire country to buy into, no, it either, right? And so, no, you do have a cultural resistance that is not only in Christian backwoods, no-teeth circles. They're also involved, probably, but you're right, it's wider than that. There are intellectuals involved. There are people that were once, you might call them liberal, that are now somewhere in a different place trying to figure out how to exist in this new environment and all of that, right? Which is, yeah, transitory and transitional, and it's trans. There's lots of trans, and for good or for ill, right? Who's the victim now, I guess, maybe would be my next question. Who's the, yeah, real victim?
Yeah, because the history is quite long, and already the term is itself a compromise, because when in the Weimar Republic, that is Germany between the world wars, you got a lot of the first pushing of what we now call transgenderism. It was still at that time called a sex change operation, because the word gender was only used to identify things inside grammar. Gender, with its implication of arbitrariness, was not yet a term used for human biology. So when we say transgenderism, we're talking about what previous generations would have called a sex change to one degree or another, not just wearing women's clothing if you're a man or vice versa, but also trying to change your biology. And some of the, when you see pictures of Nazis burning books, something you need to recognize is, you know, not in every case, obviously, but some of the books they burned were for the Institute in Berlin, run by a man named Magnus Hirschfeld, who was performing some of these, let's say, pioneering sex change operations.
Yeah. A Kinsey kind of alignment maybe there.
Yes, Kinsey is sort of an American echo into the 50s and 60s of these things in interwar Germany. And something you can really see changing besides the language is the way that this is talked about. And there's a very similar arc with homosexuality, even where that's accepting of basic human biology, I guess, to the extent that it can be. There's a very similar arc of normalization. So what is at one time, I mean, even as late as some people know, you know, Diagnostic and Statistic Manual much better than I do, but as late as the 90s or early 2000s, gender dysphoria is still a sickness that is supposed to be cured.
Right.
But what our regime does extremely effectively is discover and promote new victim classes. And this is where what we're doing today is not just about transgenderism. That's why I'm not providing like a full-on history of how it, you know, came about and progressed through the 50s and 60s and 80s and whatever, because it's really amazingly paradigmatic. Mm-hmm. So you can see from transgenderism that our politics don't function on the basis of law or natural right or a lot of the things on which our political tradition is explicitly founded. The way that our politics function is through the identification and then promotion and activism, either their own or on their behalf, of assorted protected classes or victim classes.
It's like an ongoing revolutionary war archetype that there is, you know, and there's some Marx here maybe too. I don't know. You know, I'm interrupting a little bit, but that seems to be not just the last 50 years for this Western hemisphere.
No, not at all. And it involves something that, you know, when Nietzsche is talking about the French Revolution, he talks about this, I'll just say resentment. He uses the French term, which has some sort of like deeper, almost like a grudge sense to it.
Resentiment.
Resentiment. And the reason that he uses that term is because he identifies this as a dynamic since the French Revolution. It's interesting to me that even Europeans recognize that the American Revolution is not really doing the same thing as the French Revolution. The French Revolution, and that is, I think, our political dynamic now too, whatever the US Constitution says, is built on basic, longstanding, irrevocable antagonisms and the management of the state and the military and economic power by or in or on behalf of or for the benefit of certain classes. So instead of managing the regime for the sake, as in the old regime for the aristocracy, now it will be managed for the benefit of the peasantry, right? In modern America, there are vastly more classes, let's say, or groupings that you could come up with. So race is one, but there's also economics to a lesser degree. But I think the most powerful ones, the most salient ones for most of our politics are race. But in this case, race actually, although it's part of the equation, I think that a white transsexual woman, a man, could actually get ahead of potentially a black, what's called cisgender, that is just accepting his own biology, man, by virtue of being in this way a greater or more prominent victim.
Yeah, no question, I think. I would think that the first example there would be able to trump even, say, a black woman in the way that the zeitgeist is building it right now. I mean, it's just the highest thing. It's just a matter of a couple of years. And I mean, we just got the person to be a secretary, right? But that's the spirit at work here. And so we need another term.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And I think so this sort of a third sex, let's say, neither male nor female exactly, what this can do is actually advance you. We've talked about the concept that was, you know, used quite literally at Occupy Wall Street. That's 10 years ago now, but is also used in college classrooms to a greater or lesser degree. I've seen it. I've been there for it. where, you know, if you are a Black woman, you talk before a Black man. You know, if you're an Asian man, you get to talk before white people, but probably after others, this sort of concept. One of the problems with those merely racial or, you know, too concretely gendered groupings is that they're not really expandable. I just am what I am. If I can change, then I can have power that I don't now have. I think this is part of the preponderance of white males among transgendered people.
I'm just writing down as you say that white men saw it coming, like, and they're like, wait, we're going to lose all our power. How can we get out of this one? I know. No one will see that one coming, but we did. Here we go. I don't think that's all white males, but there certainly seems to be a sociocultural blowback going on here of you strip the power, but I'm going to tyrannize you anyway. Genesis 3 would be where I get those ideas.
Well, I think it is a way to obtain power, and it's also a way to be, because along with victimhood, the heroism of being a victim, especially an ongoing victim, is enormous in our political culture too, right? And so if I want someone to look up to or I want to be inspired, I need to become a victim. It's also partly why, you know, you have to still claim that you're oppressed even if your group has disproportionate power, right? So if trans persons are whatever totally minuscule percentage of the American population, you still have to claim oppression even when you're deciding health policy for a very large state, in the case of Pennsylvania, or now at the national level. You know, you still have to say, you still have to give a sense of disproportion and oppression even when you have power. So our politics are organized around resentment rather than nature and nature's God, for example, right? So this is where I see transgenderism as salient or paradigmatic. It's not actually unusual in this way. And in some sense, it's extremely logical because it's also an expandable class of victim power. People can become trans. They're not currently allowed to become Black. Rachel Dalzell wasn't allowed to be transracial, but you can be transgender. And so that class is expandable. It's also obviously dependent in biological and medical ways we're going to talk about. But I think it's also, it's ideologically dependent, because you rely on, for instance, the same folks that are angry about Georgia election law, that is, like, you know, much of the Dow Jones industrial average, is also has been recently promoting on one of my favorite Twitter accounts, Woke Capital, the idea of the International Day of Trans Visibility. Why do you have to? I don't have a day of sun visibility or adult male visibility, because there are plenty of adult males walking around. Everyone can see them and people can see the sun. I mean, if you don't live in Fort Wayne, you can see the sun. So, but trans visibility exists in order to keep before your eyes something that would otherwise disappear. Or you'd have to say to yourself, do I actually know anyone like this? No, I do not. So the entire class of people, because of the radical nature of the group, not ideologically, it's perfectly normal to do that at this point if you go to college, but because of just the minuscule numbers of the group, they are dependent on propaganda for political power, because otherwise people would be like, what is that? Like, why are there executive orders talking about how you can get this? What is that surgery for? I've never met anybody like that. It just wouldn't even make sense to people.
I get that. So by using an extreme minority, they can basically whitewash the whole project and move any ball they want and just claim a certain thing. You got me drifting, though, on trans agenda, trans visibility, and how this I'm a super word nerd, and etymology, etymon.com, and going deep in languages. So I take language at face value more than I think a lot of people do. In fact, in some classrooms, they'd say that what I'm doing is wrong, that you can't import past meanings into present words. But I'm just not convinced it's all so segregated as that. And so, you know, a word like trans visibility, if I take that out of the current zeitgeist and just say, what does that word mean? It is fascinating what an imaginary Alice in Wonderland non-existent place we're attempting to be in when we want to have a trans agenda. Like, the word agenda means something that's stable. And now you're going to have a trans one. I mean, it, the language itself means that the language doesn't mean anything. Like, it tells you that right up front. And so it fits with the Orwellian nature of our fears, right? That war is peace, freedom is a slavery. Here it is, right there, right? We're going to follow a trans agenda. Stay with us. Wow. Oh my goodness. So then maybe this is really connected to that point I stole from you earlier, and it's tied to like the redefinition of health. And then you want to go on that a little bit?
Yeah. And something we talked about before with Confucius is that in order for government to be right, first there has to be a rectification of names. That is, names need to name something and not nothing. And they have to be honest about what they're naming rather than being dishonest or obscure. And when you're talking about health or trans women's health, and it's usually women simply because it is easier biologically to subtract than to add. So the, and I also think there's a political element. More men are going to try to become women because that's just more powerful.
Yeah, it's going to give them a leg up. Copycat, leg up.
Right.
Sure.
Right. But the idea there is that when you talk about health, the redefinition of health here is health is what is determined by experts. There's nothing native to that human being that would exist independent of experts. And this is where paradigmatically a lot of modern life has become like being transgender, in that the definition of what is healthy or good is what experts are saying.
Yeah.
It is not what is natural.
Yeah. I completely,
we've talked about masks, but we could talk just as equally about the food pyramid, where it's quite obvious that consumption of that amount of grains and also of oils that were once during World War II used to lubricate machine parts and are now in your food, that that's probably not good, even though you were told in school, this is how you should eat. So that definition of health does not proceed out of the body or what is good for the body or what would even be cheap, like get more sunlight. It proceeds out of definitions given by experts. So if experts, for instance, say, well, it's, you know, politically it's transphobic, therefore it's low class and unempowered to say that they're mentally ill, but also it's not even medically accurate to say that they're mentally ill, despite their, for instance, objective suicide rates. If experts say that, that's what health means now.
Well, what is ill and what is mentally? I jumped in earlier. I want to get the point in that the requirement for a priestly class emerges. So you talk about experts,
right.
And the sooner we can stop calling them experts and start calling them priests and see each of these giant buildings as some form of religious attempt to avoid death in some way, whether you think it's godlike or not, doesn't matter. That's the old world function of the thing is a religion. It's not a corporation. Yeah. they never have been. The lie that we're in, the story that we're in of modernism, and we changed and we can do it all without worrying about the gods, but human nature is not such. And I think it's evident now. I think you actually have an empirical evidence to say this, that human nature cannot leave the gods behind. And we've built a religious system with no religious terms. So the sooner we can put the religious terms back, the easier it's going to be to live, frankly. When I realize, oh, that's just, I got to go see the priest in order to get the prescription. Oh, well, that makes sense. I just got to pay him his duty. I don't even have to believe he thinks what he knows or knows what he thinks. I just have to get him to give me the thing. And that's the way I used to be with the big temples. So I find that helpful. I don't know. Do you find that helpful? No.
I don't find it helpful in the sense that, I mean, you know, you have the same notes I do. There is a religious element to all of this. And so I think that's right. I don't find it helpful in the sense that it then just feels like I am acquiescing to someone else's state religion, which I in fact am being asked to do.
Correct.
But the grounds for it are not in this sense traditionally religious, because the redefinition of health is something that also exists. This is why I think transgenderism is paradigmatic. It exists inside people's lives who wouldn't participate in this state religion at all, they think. We've talked before about this, the separation of sex from fertility. this is already going beyond human biology in a very profound way. And that was happening long before anyone even had heard of Richard or Rachel Levine. So I think that that redefinition of health is a very long standing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess so I'm with you on everything you said, and I'm still just sort of seeing it as a very long-standing religion of saying this isn't a religion. And the more that I can see that it is, the more free I am to reject it outright, honestly. I can when they say something like, "Well, you have to do this because these other people far away might die if you don't," I can realize that's their salvation story. That's their salvation myth. And this is the priest or the confessor, the zealot, the acolyte who's telling me this. And I can just say, "Oh, wow, no, I have a completely different planet I'm living on, but I can still be nice to you. I can assess you. I can make a discerned decision right now about how best to be a person, a neighbor, and all these things." And maybe that means I get a prescription, and maybe that means no, I won't put that mask on right here. You know, it kind of depends on where you are. But for me, seeing it as a religious spirit, I find it just much easier to reject, honestly. I can see the lie. I can believe that because they're so good at lying, and they use so much emotion and like power of moving images and music and all this to manipulate their lies that it becomes easier to believe them than it should be. And so by putting it in the category of false religion, as a Christian especially, I don't want a false religion. Now I've got a reason to like look at it very carefully and feel very confident that I have the time to do that because that's what my God would have me do. So I guess that's where I was going a little earlier.
I guess I think the kind of underlying philosophical thing going on here is I don't think that worldviews or mythologies are as powerful as analysts of worldviews or mythologies make them out to be for average people, in the sense that I don't know that I don't know that it has that kind of coherence even for the practitioners. So I think that the idea that there's something sort of basically wrong with me, and I'm on, some sort of whatever, somebody's Discord server, and they're telling me that what I really need to do is transition, forget my parents. I think that that is proceeding out of something that is extremely human and extremely sad.
True.
And I find hard to analyze on a mythological or worldview level, in the same sense that I could say, well, obviously, like Hindu mythology provides for reincarnation in a way that Christian doctrine does not. But because also we're dealing with a society that is post-Christian. So there are phenomena like transgenderism, or there are eunuchs, man-made hermaphrodites of various kinds in various societies. The distinction there is that that's usually for some sort of reinforcement of hard biological sexuality otherwise. So, shamans in assorted places in, North Asia or parts of North America that dress up as women and with whom men of the village have sex. There is something deeply unnatural about that, but it's not leading that society to question whether or not biological sex is real, full stop. Or eunuchs are used in polygamous societies to guard groups of women who are definitely women, who definitely have powerful men that need them to be protected from other powerful men. Our transgenderism does not function that way. It functions as an assault on biology. And I think that that is because I think that biology in this way precedes any mythology that explains it to me. Like part of the explanatory power of me for me in becoming a Christian was it explained things that I had observed, and it explained them coherently. What is wrong with people? I didn't really need Christianity to observe the fault in mankind, but Christianity explained where it came from and why it was what it was, right? So I think that a lot of these things exist without explanation. So if a lot of the functionaries of transgenderism are priestly, I totally agree with that. I think that at best they are very bad at their job, because they do not explain what this is or what it's for. Or for instance, if Christianity can give you an account of, if you are a Christian, where you will be in 10,000 years,
Well,
transgenderism doesn't give you an account of, okay, after you transition, what are you going to do when you're 41?
No, I don't. But see, I guess what I'm suggesting is that the trans in it isn't even about establishing that people group as sort of the ruling class. It's about an ideology of non-stability that wrecks the populace base to trust implicitly what the regime says, and that this could even be seen as one type of final solution to the problem of the world being governed. One which is hyper cult-like in all of its practices before and after injecting the trans agenda into it. And so, yeah, I don't want to sit here and do the dogmatics of American chaos. But what I want to do is free my head to realize everyone out there says they're working on like these reasonable theories. And no, they're working on these really bad mythologies. And some of them are in power. I think the one that's actually using the trans myth, if I guess narrative, story, if I can call it whatever, the one that's using that, I don't think that's really about the trans thing so much as about getting a transitional permanent power base, a moving target for who is in charge, that the people who control the information can decide what that target is when they want and move it where they want it to be. That's what I'm seeing as just happening. And
Sure.
I don't know why not to call that a world religion. I don't know why not to call that. That's a little, a little eschatological, perhaps, but.
Yeah, I think that the idea of having an entire people group identified politically by name in law with rights pertaining to them is not unique to transgenderism, but it is paradigmatic in creating a dependency that is biologically necessary. So biologically, right? So in the sense that civil rights legislation and judgments from the 1960s name most groups except for whites as the target of receiving special benefits. And so whites are not protected in civil rights law in the same sense that American blacks are. Transgenderism does something far beyond that in the sense that rather than simply having specific rights pertinent to you and corporations will threaten to leave a state or not do business with the state because they won't let you use the bathroom you want to. In addition to that, they have created something that doesn't exist if you are a black man or a Hispanic woman. And that is a specific, ongoing, permanent biological dependency on someone else's agency to maintain your identity. Right. That is far more profound than simply saying that this or that group is a protected class, veterans, blacks, the disabled, whoever. It's far more profound because it means that if we did not have the certain, pharmaceutical regimen, availability of surgeons, corrective plastic surgeries of all kinds, it is extremely expensive not only to become part of this group, but also to maintain your existence as such, because your body is rebelling against what your imagination wants and what pharmaceutical companies and the government and the Dow Jones Industrial Average companies also want for you.
Are you
And
suggest?
that, yeah, go
Go
ahead.
ahead. Are you suggesting those pills have a pretty big carbon footprint?
Yeah, well, I'm suggesting no one's ever going to mention it if they do.
Yeah,
Yeah.
right.
So that that level of dependency or reliance for your very existence on someone else, it goes way beyond being on welfare or not being able to buy your own house.
Let me say too, though, here. So by reliance, you're not even really meaning like your job and your income and your food. You're talking about the internal self-identity of the human, right? This isn't, we're not talking just
Right.
physically reliant.
Yeah.
We're
Right.
talking
Right.
about you wake up in the morning and you're able to put your pants on because you know who you are. And this is a situation where these people are saying, in this one way, I don't know how I am, but if I
Right.
do this, I do know how I am. And so I
Right.
need to do this. And what that means is very, very expensive and requiring at this point the submission of the rest of society, which is
Correct.
its own thing,
Yeah.
right? Yeah.
Yeah. We, yeah. Because an equivalent, you would have to imagine, if you're listening to this and, you're not transgender, which is probably everybody
Likely, unless they're
until,
hunting for us for some sort
yeah,
of
until they come
lawsuit
for
or
us,
something,
right?
right? Yeah.
Is that you would have to wake up and imagine that, you have brown eyes and you wake up and tomorrow you have green eyes and then the next day you have blue eyes. And that might be like kind of interesting or whatever, but imagine that that affects your biological functioning on pretty much every level. And it is generally a very gross process. A lot of things are going to happen that are very repulsive to you and to your spouse. And so you're going to have to deal with that. And you're going to have to take drugs to deal with that. This goes along with something that we talked about when we talked about the history of AIDS, in that the solution to AIDS was not behavioral change, especially not of the emergent protected class of gay men. The solution is going to be resolution and solidification and then promotion of a certain corporately profitable, but also politically salient and powerful group that has to be, that is also thus dependent on pharmaceuticals to a far greater degree even than gay men who are trying to avoid a variety of things that come with living the way they do. So this is an intensification of a lot of processes that have been going on for a long time in the West, not only politically, but we could also say culturally, or as I think you've made a good case, religiously, that the revolt against biology becomes especially profound in transgenderism, but it's not unique to transgenderism. I'm going through life trying to pretend that certain biological facts are not what they are. And in this case, everyone has to support me.
I think that every human is dealing with some level of trauma. Is really too heavy a word, but it isn't at the same time. There is trial, danger, horror in this life. You've seen some, you've heard some. Your childhood was good or bad, but has left you with being who you are, and that will be a struggle day by day. So everyone's got that. But then there are these things that are something more. A dysphoria is a good way to say it. And let me put maybe a parallel beside a dysphoria. Many people know or have had contact with a woman who has been raped. Many people may not know this, but if you go to church, in a church with more than 50 people in it, there probably is a woman there who has been raped in her life. If you spend any time counseling women who have been in this situation, they experience something not unlike a dysphoria, except it's not. They're not trying to get out of their body. They're not trying to cut their hand off like other types of dysphoria would maybe have you do. They just have all of their emotions turned backwards. And when they get up every day, their pain is pleasure and their pleasure is pain. And it causes them to question because it'll go back and forth, and they'll have moments where things are fine, and then they'll have moments where an event, say someone who looks like the person who raped them, sends them into a 3-day spin where they never get out of bed, right? And they don't even know why, maybe, at a point. They might have hidden the entire thing from their head. So living with dysphorias is no joke and should not be in any way diminished, which is where, here's kind of where the thing is with this particular conversation is we've taken something that once upon a time we would say, okay, this is a challenge to live with. It must be addressed carefully and maybe even quietly, dealing with some past events and you know, like a chemical crazy that's going on. Now we're saying, let's amplify it. Let's make it more of that. And as someone who does experience a certain trauma and a condition, I can say the last thing I would want anyone to do, now that I know what it is, I don't want you to amplify it ever. Like, never make it more of what it is. I just as soon learn to be what I naturally am as opposed to what my personal experience kind of tricked me into wanting to be or trying to be and all that. And all that'll come up some other time in the future. But for this point, though, to see that this dysphoria issue is no joke. It is a cognizant issue that every morning you're getting up and you are living through having to learn who you are again because of the mental fight, the fracturing, the attacks that go on, the internal critic, whatever it is. And so now you have a people class that are going to fix this entirely, sort of, repress this entirely, really, with a pill and more than that. And again, wanting to repress the entire social structure so that they can do it and not be told that anyone disagrees with them about them doing it, which shows you how fragile their reconstruction of reality is, right? The more recovered you are from any trauma, the less fragile you will be. The less someone saying they disagree with you about it will give you trouble, like, which is the issue right now, right? They want everyone to affirm them constantly.
Right. Yeah. And I think that there is a cruelty that I think you were very right to identify in reinforcing someone's inability to live inside their own body, to push that, to make that normal, to constantly call to attention that they should become something else biologically. And that cruelty will, I think transgenderism along with abortion will be the single greatest indictments. I mean, if our civilization is wiped from the face of the earth and becomes equal to the Carthaginians, about whom most listeners probably know quite little, that would be just, because the notion that we would encourage people to destroy their own bodies and to kill their young, and that that would be publicly funded and publicly affirmed rather than something shameful and secret wherever it did rarely occur, that is completely insane. And that's what we are. So I understand why people say, you know, the world's going crazy or the world has been turned upside down. And I do think a lot of that has to do with the media. But I also find it difficult to be sympathetic with people's current outrage. I do not know what they thought would happen, because I don't see transgenderism as all that unusual. This is a society which in so many ways reinforces all that is worst in human nature and amplifies it.
Correct.
In the same sense that the casino, you know, wants addictive gamblers.
The story of Pinocchio and the story of Alice in Wonderland, Animal Farm too, I suppose, but more and more, these images from my childhood have become prophetic, you know, and Pinocchio particularly, this Pleasure Island that appears so good, and he's mm-hmm. so enticed by this possibility of life there. Maybe he can really be a boy there, right? And instead, yeah. it all just turns into a horror film.
Right.
And this is the right. casino. The casino, when you aren't saying the emperor has no clothes, it's all really beautiful here, it's horrific. It's horrific. And that's why no one wants to turn the lights off, as it were. That's mix my metaphors. No one wants to open their eyes yeah. and really look at it. Yeah. Our listeners are doing that, and that's why they're here. We've talked about most of your notes for today. You had a few more cool points about trans as religion, though. I kind of stole that thunder a little bit, too. But did you want to kind of go into the language takes on prayerful religious tone from
I think there's something to be said there about language, and there's something to be said, and I want to name some names today about things that are self-consciously religions accepting some of this religion. So one of the thing about language is that it's sort of hilarious. You can find both unironic statements from U.S. senators and also then a lot of hilarious ironic statements on the internet about what is infrastructure, because into the Biden infrastructure package of trillions, they're trying to stuff lots of things. You know, women's business empowerment programs are infrastructure. Paid child leave is infrastructure. That's actually a quote. And so what you do, the reason that you talk that way, and the reason that things like the Anti-Defamation League and the American Civil Liberties Union will tweet out things like trans women are women, trans women are women, trans women are women. The way that that language works, that's what Jesus would call vain repetition, is because it works almost hypnotically. If I hear it enough, it can somehow become true, or I can make myself believe it.
Right.
And the form of that is really revelatory of the content. The form shows me that the content is unbelievable, probably even to many of the people saying it, in the same sense that people can be convinced in openly polytheistic societies to abandon the, you know, favoring one God for favoring another. And the reason they do that is because one works and the other doesn't. It's really, I think a lot of human religion is extremely pragmatic. And so the ACLU is doing that to make people, or the ADL or whoever, to make people believe something that 10 years ago they didn't even know, you know, as if now there are just unicorns running everywhere in suburban America. And I need to acknowledge them and acknowledge that they're valid. 10 years ago, I didn't even believe in unicorns. I didn't think they existed. So the form of the language is really important. And this is why I see resistance to these things. And I'll start with religion. We can talk about other realms of life. But we had a case in our church several years ago where a retired pastor decided to become a woman and was welcomed by a church under some sort of circumstances. but was welcomed by Chad Bird, who people follow on the internet, as his sister in Christ. And what is so insidious about things like that is that you are now worshiping Moloch and you're saying it's Yahweh. So you've gotten rid of Yahweh and his ways,
is
and
there any
you are
other
now
way,
worshiping
Dr. Cruz,
Moloch openly.
Is there any other way? And it's Moloch's way. I'm just saying, like, Moloch likes it this
right.
way. This is pretty much the way
yeah,
it
he
goes.
Does.
keep going.
Right. And so, you know, while we're at it, while we're acquiring fresh, middle-aged, formerly male pastor sisters in Christ, let's talk about fetuses and how they're parasitic. It's the same language. And the adoption of the language signals an adoption of the teaching, and the adoption of the teaching will lead to an adoption of the practice. And this is how we corrode even when we look solid, because what happens is that we adopt doctrine through language, and then our doctrine bears certain kinds of fruit. I think that sort of like disappeared as a thing, as things are wont to do within Lutheranism. And I think, thankfully, the man returned to wanting to be a man, as far as I know. So that's good. But the episode was, to me, revelatory that the way that change occurs, especially in a group that cannot acknowledge change very well, if at all, is by putting new teachings inside old frameworks. Like, it sounds like you're welcoming someone who's newly baptized, but it's a trans person. And in fact, in, you know, our sort of estranged cousin, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, they do have rebaptisms for people that go through gender reassignment, or I'm sorry, gender alignment surgery in many cases. So,
Where was that? What sister?
That you can find that inside the ELCA. You can find people getting baptized when they change sex and get a new name.
Okay.
Yeah.
I thought it was when people were coming back and they were trying to, you know, so bad question. Go
no,
on.
No. But so that is where I think you can see that the resistance to this, if this is given up, and I can see it being given up by many religious Christians because it feels unloving, or as people who don't know the Gospels like to say, not Christ-like. If this is given up, I think pretty much anything else can be given up, because it's such a test of how much dissonance you're willing to
right.
put up with
right.
between what you know and what it is demanded that you acknowledge.
Right. So earlier you reminded me of a story, and I color more than I should with these ancient stories, but Genghis Khan, when he was going west and getting all the way to Spain almost by the time he was done, there were some kind of eastern edge of Byzantium kingdoms, Christian kingdoms, that were there in his way, you know, as he's going. And mm-hmm. he sends messages to them and says, you know, his general thing is, you know, submit to me, because if you don't, you're going to die. And it's quite brutal. Good history on that you can get somewhere else. But the group kind of sends back to him, like we're a Christian, and we are here with the true God, so you will be unable to attack us. You can't defeat us, so don't do it. And Genghis Khan, who had some interaction with Christianity already, and I think this guy was pretty clever, so here's where I'm going to color the lines a little bit, but mm-hmm. You know, he knew the Bible. He had come into contact with the Bible before. People had tried to convert him. His message he sends back, no color on my part, is, that's the God that sent me to destroy you because you don't believe what it says in your books. Right. And he just, oh my goodness. Right. So when you stand there in the name of Moloch or whoever and claim to be something that you're not, mm-hmm. you have set yourself up to be black swaned in ways you cannot fathom. And again, this show is again about not so much about running in terror that this is the case, but maybe realizing how this is kind of always the case. And that the short game that is sold to you is actually part of the problem, and that the long game isn't as bad as you think, but maybe does involve spirituality, you know, nature. So some things that you're going to have to take some time to reintroduce to your physical life. Yeah? Does that sound like a good summary there?
Yeah, because I think that we, I mean, I'm willing to be proven wrong. I hope I'm not wrong, because it's like, what else comes after this? But
aliens.
I think that things,
Zombies? Sorry.
are coming to a head in what is being demanded.
Yeah.
What kinds of assent, what kinds of compliance. And this will be probably have severe personal and institutional consequences for a lot of people. If you're not willing to accept those, you have to realize that nothing good is going to happen, because you're going to be required to accept these things in the same sense that you're required to accept a lot of things as normal that, you know, your grandparents probably didn't think was normal. So the amount of change, the kind of change, the amount of propaganda, the demands for assent to the propaganda are probably uniquely strong and intense in the case of transgenderism. But I think also go for all sorts of other kinds of change and demand for change plus hope that have been going on probably since the beginning of time, with maybe a particular intensity in our place and our time because of the nature of media, but nonetheless are probably perennial problems.
Yeah, the nature of media has catalyzed it, and then the ability to hold or pretend to hold a global narrative is a godlike, supernatural-esque power. And
yeah.
those humans that now have this at their fingertips, I mean, they are gods of a sort, at least to us, compared to us, what they're able to move and do. And when then they put it to their own self-assumed godhood to normalize their imagination upon the world, well, that's what's happening. We're just watching it, right?
Yeah.
It's not like two people. it's a huge mass of people. There's 7 billion people on the planet, and there's a lot of elites, even though there's not that many compared to the rest of us. But we're in it now. We still have, you know, another 6 minutes till our hour's up, and I definitely want to give a listener the time. So anything else you want to talk about this morning in this level? But for me to keep circling around the deservedness of it getting worse and expecting kind of the worst, with the other side of it being that it's going to get worse for the elite and their dreams, not for the sparrows, probably, you know, depending on where you are, a little bit. And so there's a lot of hope here, too, I think.
No.
I don't think this religion is as strong as it thinks it is. It's just asking too much. And the physical toll it's taking on people, with nothing to say of what untested vaccines, grandfathering in further updates to those vaccines. I just read about that this week. You know, so that they're going to be bringing out more stuff without testing it because it's already in and we're just using it. You know, what that's going to bring about, I just don't think it's going to bring about like amazing physicality, peace on earth, and everyone happy. And so
yeah.
I don't think that it's going to last, because humans,
yeah.
they can't live as absolute slaves forever. They just die. They give up. They die. And then those who are living and thriving, well, they're going to live and thrive.
I think people can live as slaves for a very long time. I do not think that humans can revolt against biology for a very long time.
So I overspoke. I agree. That's really what I was getting at. Thank you.
So because humans subject to other humans' control is historically extremely normal. Doesn't mean it's good. It just means it's normal. Humans trying to live inside, you know, 10-year floodplains just doesn't eventually work. The jungle will take back what belongs to it. And so the idea that we can revolt against basic biological facts, givens of nature, is not finally possible. It's also the ground of hope that we have in our own native political tradition, apart from the overlay, and I think the current vast predominance of a dynamic much more native to the French Revolution of resentment, victimhood, and constant antagonism. We're seeing that right now in Minneapolis. We're probably going to see it in a lot more places if Derek Chauvin is anything except, you know, shot in the head on the spot at the end of his trial. If he gets a mistrial or, heaven forbid, acquitted, horrible things are going to happen. That is not actually natural. It does not have to be that way in America. And it is that way because of the predominance of a politics of resentment rather than of nature. Because in nature, I don't have to ensure your compliance to my delusions. I have to figure out what to do and how to do it best with what I have been given, with the sort of given boundaries of life as a man in a given ecology or whatever other factors you could take into account. So I think I think that it's not just salient, paradigmatic of lots of other things going wrong. I think it's also salient or paradigmatic of the incredible fragility of our regime, not only the government structure or something, or the military in which you can get free sex reassignment surgery. Also the fragility of our collective psychoses and delusions and ways of life in their intense dependence on lots of other complex factors, the pharmaceutical industry, lots of things. And that complex interdependence relies on lots of things I don't think we have enough of anymore, such as common agreement, trust, and public assent to publicly obvious things. So as that decays or erodes, I think that you will find immense fragility in the regime and its capacities for compliance.
Yeah. Man's heart cannot beat well when it's enslaved to a lie. And that's what I was trying to get at before with my use of the idea of slavery, because what we're experiencing right now, I'm not the debt slavery that we've been talking about a lot doesn't apply. And that's where I overspoke at the term. But within the context of the conversation, we've really been talking about the internal mind and what ideas are running your heart and whether or not someone from outside is telling you you have to believe different than what you believe. And that's where the heart just can't live like that. When you know it's a lie.
Yeah. Yeah.
Your body's not going to let you do it eventually. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, your heart can't live with lies for so long in the same sense that your body can't, you know, live off like linseed or rapeseed oil in all of your food.
What?
Right.
Oh, there is news. A, what?
Yeah. There are basic limits to you and understanding of where those limits are and acceptance of those limits is a way toward, because when I think about someone who is transgender, I feel immense sadness that they have been reinforced in those things to a greater degree, but of the same kind that I feel when someone who is morbidly obese is told that they're beautiful just the way they are. We all know that's a lie. We know it is. That's why we have to say it over and over and over again. Mantras always replace doctrine. Mantras replace truth. And so there is a reinforcement there of basic human dysfunction, whether biological or spiritual or both. And when those things are reinforced, I feel immense sadness and empathy for that person, because that person as a human being deserves better than reinforcement of lies. I mean, I wouldn't do what I do for a living, let alone this podcast, if I thought that human beings should be made to live on lies. So when you're thinking about your own life, I would also think about the ways in which you are being transitioned into unnatural things in all sorts of realms of life and try to pull yourself back. And that's a constant battle, because in our rather insane society, we're not encouraged toward what is natural or simple or doesn't cost anything or not a whole lot long term. We're encouraged into what is expensive and increases dependency and decreases basic functioning, decreases basic happiness and contentment. So you have to fight for happiness and contentment, but I think the battle's worth it.
Reliance on vain repetition, needing to be surrounded by a cult-like world that tells you you are what you are when everything inside you tells you that you're not that. Believing that to be a victim is better than to be an overcomer. These are things which trap you, which enslave your mind, which tell you that this world is not worth living in, which is amazing, given that it's so obvious that it is. So the fear that creeps over your shoulder when you are about to talk about something and you kind of look back behind you to see if someone's there, you know, do you really want me to say this? That's what I encourage you to just call out the lie on. The moment you catch yourself questioning, the moment you're lowering your voice, just don't do that. You don't have to say what you would have said. You don't have to go and be a martyr somewhere. But let's make a pact with each other that we're going to not let these stories from far away be the ghosts behind us telling us what to think. You're listening to A Brief History Power with Two White Guys, and if you needed to know who we are, you would not have listened this long.